I'm Peter O'Dowd, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support your NPR station at donate.npr.org/now. Here and Now helps you make sense of the world right now, the impact of the pandemic on every aspect of our lives, the transition to the Biden administration, and how that will change Washington and America and your hometown, and all the stories from around the country, the local and regional news that resonates everywhere. So make a donation today, and that investment will come right back to you. It is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. This morning, Vice President Mike Pence rolled up his sleeve, got the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine, and thanked the doctors who gave it to him.
I didn't feel a thing. Well done. And we appreciate your service to the country.
And on Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he's optimistic that a coronavirus relief deal to help people struggling during the pandemic is close at hand. Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Jesse Holland is a host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
And Beth Fooey. I am well, thank you. And Beth Fooey is Senior Politics Editor at NBC News. Hi, Beth. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, millions of people are desperate for coronavirus relief. One of them is unemployed house cleaner Beverly Vonderstock of Steelville, Missouri, who told us what she would say to lawmakers who've taken months to negotiate another relief bill.
If anything, I would want to tell them is they need to just hurry up and, you know, I'm trying to get a job. It's not like I'm just sitting here every day. And when you have $100 a week of income coming in and, will you decide, do you want to feed your family or pay your bills or, you know, what do you do?
It's so hard to hear her. And she's one of so many Americans who are dealing with this in this situation right now. Democrats are calling any deal a down payment. Republicans are talking about keeping costs down. Beth, what calculations is each side making in trying to get this done?
Well, that soundbite you just played from that woman is just so heartbreaking. And it just reminds you of how much of a disconnect exists right now between the members of Congress who are allegedly negotiating a new deal, although we still haven't seen anything yet, and millions of Americans who are either unemployed, semi-employed, businesses that are just barely hanging on. This is a major crisis. This is a time for government to act. If there's ever a time for government to act is when we are in the middle of a crisis of this magnitude. And Congress did the right thing back in the spring by passing through a very large stimulus relief bill back in March. It helped keep millions of Americans afloat. It helped keep businesses afloat. But most of those provisions have died out at this point, and many of them months ago. And a few more are going to go out of business on December 26th if Congress doesn't act. So it's very strange that politicians of either side of the aisle would not just jump on board and recognize the urgency here. This isn't a time to talk about austerity or when we're going to reduce our debt or deficit. We are in a crisis situation. This is what government money is for. And the fact that it has been so hung up on things that really don't ultimately matter all that much when it comes to the fate of Americans' homes and livelihoods just a couple days before Christmas is pretty astonishing.
We have seen some unusual political bedfellows, progressive Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and conservative Missouri Senator Josh Hawley joined forces to push for stimulus checks. Jesse, your thoughts on this?
Well, here's the thing. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was not a fan of doing a bill at all from the beginning. But in Georgia, with Republican Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler tied up in a close race with two upstart Democrats. And those races are going to decide whether Majority Leader Mitch McConnell keeps his position as Majority Leader. They're finding out that in Georgia, the Democrats are really pounding the Republicans for not getting something done earlier and for not getting this bill done. So we're seeing a bigger push from Mitch McConnell to get something through to help out his colleagues in Georgia to maybe to blunt some of the effects that not having COVID relief has put on their reelection campaigns. So now mm-hmm. we're seeing both sides trying to push something through. The question is still, how much money are they willing to put in that relief bill?
Yes, and I think we'll be watching Mitch McConnell. Right. And Mitch McConnell actually put it this way. He said that the GOP incumbent senators in Georgia are getting hammered by their Democratic opponents in the runoffs for not delivering a stimulus deal that includes direct checks. I want to move on now to Joe Biden's pick for New Mexico Democratic Congresswoman Deb Haaland to be his Interior Secretary. If she's confirmed, she'll be the first Native American to lead the Interior Department, another Biden cabinet member focused on climate change. And it would at least temporarily further the very narrow lead that Democrats hold in the House. We'll see about who would replace her if she does indeed get the position. What's being said about the choice of Haaland?
I think it's definitely historic.
We've never seen a Native American cabinet member, and certainly the Interior Department has a sort of fraught relationship over the years with the Native American community because it controls so much of America's public land. You know, Joe Biden is doing what he said he was going to do. He's making history with a lot of these cabinet picks, including Deb Haaland, and he's also being very clear that climate change and environmental degradation, and certainly the environmental challenges that are faced by people of color more than others, has been on his mind. He's making good on promises that he made during the campaign.
And also, I'd like Jesse, you to comment on this. Biden also picked North Carolina environmental regulator Michael Regan, who, if confirmed, would become the first African-American to lead the EPA, signaling an emphasis on environmental justice. How are Republicans reacting to this? Are they gearing up to block some of Biden's picks?
Well, once again, it all depends on those Georgia runoffs. If the Democrats take the Senate with Vice President Kamala Harris as the deciding vote, then we don't have to worry about President Biden's, whether Republicans can block President Biden's picks because they'll have the majority.
But let's say
if that
doesn't. Yeah, right. And let's say that may not happen. So let's say it doesn't.
So if it doesn't happen, we have to keep in mind that, first of all, most presidents get carte blanche with their first picks, unless it's someone egregiously outside of the mainstream. It would be very hard for a Senate to tell a president that you can't have your own people. Right now, it doesn't seem like President-elect Biden has chosen anyone that the Republicans are willing to say right now that this person is unacceptable. So right now, and once again, I keep saying right now because we never know what's going to pop up in the media in the next couple of days. Right now, it seems like most of President Biden's picks will go through.
I want to ask you, too, about something else. So Biden spoke with CBS Late Show host Stephen Colbert about the Justice Department's investigation of his son Hunter's taxes. Let's listen.
We have great confidence in our son. I am not concerned about any accusations been made against him. It's used to get to me. I think it's kind of foul play. But look, it is what it is. And he's a grown man.
Beth, your thoughts on this whole investigation. Is he going to be able to brush this off so easily?
Well, it's been very unclear to me how anything that Hunter Biden may have done connects in any way to his father. I mean, obviously, you could certainly say that Hunter Biden may have traded on his name to get some of the positions that he got. But whether Joe Biden was involved in any of the activities that the Justice Department is investigating or that congressional investigators looked into, nobody's come up with anything. There's been no connection made whatsoever. And this thing has already been fairly thoroughly investigated. So, you know, it's going to go through. It is a little awkward, obviously, that it's an ongoing investigation that will continue under the President Joe Biden. But it's unless Joe Biden is somehow implicated directly in anything that Hunter was doing that was considered to be questionable or nefarious, I don't see how it touches the presidency at all.
Jesse, we're about halfway through this presidential transition. Trump still has not conceded and still claims fraud. Do you think that Biden's message is cutting through? Is Trump's voice diminishing?
Well, of course, it's going to diminish as we get closer to Inauguration Day when he'll become former President Trump. What we see now, however, is a bit of a resistance showing up in the government. We found out today that the newly appointed defense secretary is telling the Pentagon not to participate or not to coordinate with the Biden transition. So there are still some segments of the Trump administration that are still trying to fight to make it as hard as possible for President-elect Joe Biden to come in. And it doesn't seem like President Trump himself will ever actually concede. He may end up leaving the White House, but we will probably never hear him say that he lost the election. That would reduce his power in the Republican Party. And that's the last thing that President Trump wants.
We don't have too much more time left, but Beth, I wonder if you can weigh in on the what intelligence officials are saying about this major espionage cyber hack of government and commercial networks by Russia. Does it surprise you that Donald Trump has not been talking about this?
Yeah, it's fairly shocking, actually, that he has not said a word about it. But let's face it, he's not talking about the pandemic that's killing 3,200 Americans every single day. He is not talking about any of the issues that, as president, he ought to be addressing. He seems to very much want to win a re-election to a job that he doesn't really intend to carry out. So it's sort of a strange strategy that he's focusing on the process of trying to get back into office, even though he is abdicating the responsibilities of president right now.
Thank you. That's Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News, and Jesse Holland, a host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hope for an end to the pandemic is growing as more healthcare workers get the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine and as the Food and Drug Administration considers authorizing vaccine for Moderna for emergency use. That authorization could come as early as today. A panel of independent advisors recommended authorization yesterday. Dr. Walter Orenstein is the associate director of the Emory Vaccine Center at Emory University in Atlanta. We should note that he is advising Moderna and is also a participant in the company's vaccine trial. Dr. Orenstein, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Given what medical workers have been through this year, what's it like to know that more vaccine help is on the way?
I think it's wonderful news. Our goal is to vaccinate all Americans, but we don't have the doses. Having another company and more vaccine will allow us to move forward more quickly.
And what are your concerns about the distribution at this point? There are some states that are reporting receiving fewer of the Pfizer vaccine doses than they thought they would get. Is this going to be a problem?
I think the major issue is that the companies and the distribution system can get the vaccine doses out. So we need the production from the companies and then out to the various sites. And then we need to assure that vaccines for those for whom it's recommended have easy access to those vaccines.
Will many people have the option of having one vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine or Moderna? And if we do, how do we make that choice?
I'm not aware of whether there will be choices or not. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices is meeting tomorrow and will decide if there's any recommendation for one vaccine over another. My own feeling at the stage that I've seen, I would accept either vaccine. Two doses are recommended, and I would get two doses of the same vaccine. But the vaccines seem to be very, very comparable, and I would get whatever I could get.
Well, you say they're very comparable, but they do have different makeups and different mechanisms in the way they work. I don't want you to go through the explanation for that, but is that not something that the consumers should know about and consider, or at least have their doctors consider?
I think certainly they're both messenger RNA vaccines, and they both have lipid coats to get into the cells of our body to induce an immune response. But I think, to me, what's very important is that information be given to every potential vaccine on what we know about the efficacy and safety, so that, and in fact, the emergency use authorizations require such information be provided.
And I know you're encouraging people to not wait and to get the vaccine without hesitation. There do seem to be a lot of people who may take it, but want to wait and see. Is there anything wrong with a cautious approach?
To me, I think the issue, vaccines do two things. One, they protect the individual who gets an active immune response. Number two, hopefully, and there's preliminary data to suggest that it will reduce transmission and hence protect society. We don't know that for sure. We will have to look at it. But I think it is important to try and get as soon as possible. The vaccines have been evaluated in super large trials in the tens of thousands of vaccinees and placebo recipients. So to me, given the explosion we're seeing in COVID-19 cases, I would want to get vaccine as soon as I can.
Dr. Orenstein, thank you very much.
Thank you. And I hope I received the vaccine in the Moderna trial. If not, I will want to get the vaccine as soon as I'm eligible.
Yeah, we should say that you're not sure at this point if you got the placebo or the actual vaccine. So you have a personal stake in this as well.
Yes, I want the vaccine.
Good luck to you, and thank you. Walter Orenstein, Associate Director of the Emory Vaccine Center at Emory University in Atlanta. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Infuriating. That's how one woman described a column recently published in the Wall Street Journal that asserts incoming First Lady Jill Biden should drop the title doctor when she officially moves into the White House. Biden has a doctorate in education, and Joseph Epstein writes that it's a title that should only be used for medical doctors. And that struck a nerve with women who earn PhDs, who say they found in their lives that there is a double standard, and that this column highlights a pervasive issue of sexism in academia. This is such a hot fire topic that yesterday, when I mentioned in a tease that we'd be talking about this on the show, I got several emails from listeners, all men, who said this was a non-issue. And we're disappointed that we were having this conversation. Barbara Rodriguez has heard a lot of this criticism, too. She's a reporter for the 19th, and she spoke to several women who hold PhDs. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What the writer of this column, Joseph Epstein, was saying is that the incoming First Lady should take the title of First Lady and do away with doctor as part of her role. Why did that strike a nerve with women PhD holders?
The original response to the piece, there was just so much outrage. And I think that my colleagues and I were trying to peel back the layer a little bit because it's ultimately a conversation over identity. Women in academia are able to move up in their respective careers because of the additional educational credentials that they obtain or that society tells them that they must obtain. And I got the feeling that a criticism of credentials on such a prominent figure was by extension a criticism on them. And I think that that's part of why there was such a response to it.
And you actually spoke with several women who said this brought to light this pervasive problem, women not being taken seriously in academia. What were some of the stories they told you?
There was this universal response of stories from women talking about working with students who would call them miss versus doctor, professor, or just a more formal title, or having self-doubt about when to use their advanced degrees in conversation or acknowledging it in how they move about the world. And so there was just this real sense of complexity, but also microaggressions that had been building up over a long period of time. And a lot of it is still there today. You know, some of these stories were very fresh in their minds and in terms of just things that they've faced over very recent years.
NPR and Here and Now follow the AP style book, which uses the title doctor for individuals who hold a medical degree. So that's dentists and veterinarians and optometry. That's for clarity so that listeners understand that we're talking about medical doctors versus academic doctors. You note that usually the 19th actually does the same, but for this particular piece, you decided to use the title for your subjects who hold any PhD. Why was that?
You know, like you noted, the 19th largely uses the AP style book, but we had so many women that just spoke with so much heart about the complexities of this subject and just having this conversation over this title, I feel like we felt like it was really relevant to have that conversation and to highlight that point. I've not seen a debate over the use of doctoral degrees in terms of that AP style book, and maybe one will emerge. You know, I'm not sure, mm-hmm. but I had additional people reach out who work in academia, kind of just pointing to that AP style book footnote, and I think it also resonated with readers.
Hmm. Jill Biden actually responded to this column in a tweet where she says, quote, "Together we will build a world where the accomplishments of our daughters will be celebrated rather than diminished." We hear that she'll actually continue teaching even after she enters the White House with her husband next month, which will actually make her the first working first lady. Do women you spoke with feel they have a champion in her?
I think so. I spoke to at least one English professor who works at a community college who said, "That's me. She's me." Because Dr. Biden also teaches at a community college. And this individual pointed to the fact that she feels that the future First Lady is going to be entering the White House with a perspective on education, on higher education, on community colleges that's going to be elevating the voices of underrepresented communities. The education field is filled with women. And, you know, there's historical context there. But I think education has a particular meaning for not just people in academia, but people in general in a year when teachers are doing more work than ever to educate America's children because of the pandemic. And so I think people are very much closely following what she does.
This column highlighted a pervasive issue and problem. It really struck a nerve with so many women who are PhD holders. Do you think this will really push us forward to have a more critical conversation about the use of the term and title doctor?
You know, we'll see. I think all I can note is the fact that the piece and the conversation around identity and title really resonated with our readers. And language and its use in our writing is constantly evolving. And I'm curious myself to see how that conversation moves forward in our industry.
Barbara Rodriguez is the State House reporter for the 19th, a new publication reporting on gender politics and policy. And we'll link you to her piece at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, Barbara.
Thank you for having me.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
Suicide rates have been rising in the United States in recent years. And while the rate of suicides is higher in white communities, this year that trend changed at least in one state. A new study finds that when Maryland went into a pandemic lockdown in March, the number of suicides among white residents went down, and the number of black residents who died by suicide went up during this same time period. NPR's health correspondent Ritu Chatterjee is here to break this down for us. And Ritu, tell us what this study found.
Sure. So the researchers at Johns Hopkins University looked at the number of suicide deaths in Maryland from January of this year to July and found that when the state went into lockdown in the spring, there was an overall decline in suicides that was driven primarily by a decline in the number of suicides by white residents. But suicide deaths among black residents had nearly doubled during that time period.
How does the lack of access to care play out in all of this?
Oh, I'm guessing it's a huge factor here, not just access to physical health care, but also mental health care. And as researchers tell me, there's also more stigma around seeking help for mental health. And obviously, during the pandemic, you know, access to a lot of care was affected. Everything went virtual. Everything was just harder at the time.
The black communities have dealt with traumas and disadvantages for a long time. Is there something specific about this time that might have led to this rise? As we said in the beginning, suicide is a bigger problem in white communities in this country.
Exactly. And that's a great point. You know, I was speaking with psychologist Rita Walker she's at University of Houston, and she wasn't involved in this new study, but her research focuses on these factors that influence suicide risk in African Americans, both factors that increase and factors that decrease the risk. And she made the exact same point as you.
Black folks have suffered trauma for many generations, but have still survived. And we've not seen suicide death rates that are commensurate with the level of risk that one would expect.
However, she did make another observation. She said research has shown, including her own work, that one thing that reduces the risk of suicide and increases, what she called psychological resilience for the Black community is just this ability to come together, to gather together during difficult times to support one another. And religion also plays a protective role. And the public health measures to keep us safe from COVID-19 have basically stripped away people's ability to gather in person, as well as in places of worship. And she wonders if that might have played a role in the suicide deaths in Maryland. That said, I should point out here that suicide is very complex. There's never a single cause. Usually mm-hmm. involves a combination of risk factors. So at the moment, we just don't know. But there is a similar rise in suicides in Black residents in Chicago during the pandemic. It's a troubling trend, even if a small one, and something to put on the radar of policymakers and public health workers, especially as we head into this winter where COVID-19 cases are rising. And, they should be aware that Black people can also be at a higher risk of suicide during this time, so that those most at risk have access to mental health care, as well as, social support, other needs like food, housing, that can have a huge impact on people's mental health.
Ritu, thank you so much for breaking down the details of this important study. That's Ritu Chatterjee, NPR health correspondent. The time has come. The finale of season 2 of The Mandalorian drops today on the streaming service Disney Plus. For the last 8 weeks, fans have followed the tale of a bounty hunter, the Mandalorian, and an alien child he has sworn to protect, set in the Star Wars universe.
You must reunite it with its own kind.
You expect me to search the galaxy for the home of this creature?
This is the way.
The atmosphere is just as much a character as the Mandalorian and the baby, and this season takes us all over the galaxy, from the dusty dunes of the desert planet Tatooine to a military base deep under a volcanic plain. And joining us to break down what goes behind the building of the world, the Mandalorian, is perhaps one of the luckiest guys in show business, Andrew L. Jones, production designer for the show. Andrew, great to have you here.
Oh, thanks, Tanya.
The Star Wars universe, whether you're a fan or not, we all know the distinct aesthetic of it. It's immediately clear that The Mandalorian, which was created by Jon Favreau, is very intentional in maintaining that original look of A New Hope. But the thing about that very first movie is that there wasn't a lot of money for set design. So how much of a challenge was it to actually maintain that aesthetic while also having so many new technologies and really a lot more money?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That was John's very strong initial intention, was that we would be channeling the DNA of those early movies. And, I'm working with Doug Chang from Lucasfilm and his amazing team of artists up there who live and breathe Star Wars. But I got to say, you mentioned that the original filmmakers had a limited budget. And they did for sure. But I got to say, after the experience of working on season 1 of this show and recreating some of their sets and trying to channel what they did, I'm just amazingly impressed with what they managed to achieve. And I think that's part of why it was so successful, is that they had such ambition and were able to make it all work and introduce new technologies and, the birth of ILM. So, this has been a tough show, very ambitious. But by the time we were done, I was just in awe of what the original filmmakers had achieved.
And speaking of new technology, The Mandalorian actually uses this wraparound screen called the Volume that actually projects the landscapes instead of a traditional green screen. What was it like incorporating that digital tech into physical sets?
It's, we really had to figure it out as we went along. John kind of understood what the technology and what the capabilities were and was happy to sort of embark on this. And we'd kind of scratched the surface of this a little bit, but actually putting a physical set in amongst this and having the physical world tie into the virtual world was kind of new to us. So we've learned the things that work, the things that don't work. But the thing is, when it does work, it's extraordinary. It really is. I mean, you know, that it's not just like a translate or a picture that wraps around you. It actually moves, and the parallax changes as the camera moves. It's seeing the environment from different points of view. So it's which makes all the difference. It just sells the depth. But there's a lot of other quirks and anomalies that you have to deal with to do with luminosity and color and focus. So we've kind of developed a process for this and are able to be more ambitious. But it's a TV show, and we have to sort of fit into the TV rhythm.
I can only imagine your days are long but exciting because you're creating something that you know that folks will cherish. And as you mentioned, that level of detail brings so much of the story to life, from the clutter of the docks of Trask, the graffiti and the neon signs of the Outer Rim metropolis at the start of the season. Once you have a set, what's the process of actually populating all of these small details that make it so realistic for us?
We've got, like I say, we're working with Doug Chang and his illustrators from San Francisco at Lucasfilm, and they actually work in 3D models. So that's kind of the start of the process. So we're creating the whole world kind of like a video game. Because of that, we can start putting in all of those details. We can bring in assets from previous Star Wars shows or video games, and we can scan props and bring those into the world. And then, you know, the directors, we all scout it in VR. And then when we've kind of got that figured out, I got to go in and slice out the part of this virtual world that I'm going to make physical. And that then goes to the regular art department who are going to dissect that, find out how they're going to build it, how much they have to build. Honestly, what I'm finding is the less that we have to build, the better. Sometimes the best sets are the very simplest. Also, we've got, like, the volume is this tremendously sophisticated bit of technology, you know, very expensive LED panels and the system that runs it. You know, cutting-edge stuff, really incredibly expensive and fancy all around us. And we're in the middle with little bulldozers and shovels and, you know, throwing dirt around and trying not to get it on there. And then ponds with water, you know, if we get a leak, it's a lot more of an issue than if it were just to be on a regular stage.
So, oh, my anyway, gosh, I didn't think about that. No, it's exciting, but yeah. I also didn't think about that. You have all of this sophisticated technology, and then you have the practical things that make the set look real, and you can't have those intersect, especially water. It does not work with technology, sure.
Yeah, on season one, we were doing the sand crawler treads, and we'd been putting mud onto the sand crawler in the virtual world. And when we got that loaded on, we had one track that was virtual and one track that was real. And these are huge, like 12-foot tall Caterpillar tracks. And on the morning that we were going to shoot, we brought our set in, but it wasn't muddy enough. So the whole greens department and myself all ran in and started madly throwing mud onto the treads to get it dirty enough before the company arrived. Yeah. And I saw a place on one of the treads that didn't have enough mud. And I threw the mud at it, but it was on the screens. So completely trashed a bit of the screen.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
That's how convincing it is, though.
Yeah. And you have to recover really quickly because time is short, as you said. You've mentioned Jon Favreau quite a bit. We know about his intense love for Star Wars and, you know, he's the creator of The Mandalorian. The love put into not only the sets, but the entire storyline is palpable. I think I actually heard you say in another interview that you first saw A New Hope with your mom when you were 14.
That's right.
Does it feel like a dream to work on such a beloved story?
Oh, it totally does. You know, when I first went in, there was three factors that totally sold me. One was working with John. I'd worked with John on Jungle Book, and I knew how, you know, really smart, really good to work with. That's enough right there. But also the technology, which is extraordinary. And I've been working in these visual effects heavy projects for a number of years, and this is like the pinnacle of all of that for me. And then the property is, you know, I'm a total fan of Star Wars. So those three together, you know, like you say, I feel like I'm the luckiest designer there is.
Andrew, is there anything else I didn't ask you? I mean, I'm sure, like, we could talk about this for hours, but is there any particular part of your work that you want to share with us that I didn't ask you?
Yeah, I guess one other thing is this project, more than any other, has been tremendously collaborative. And what's interesting about this now for me is that we've got an amazing team of traditional artists, artisans, painters, sculptors, plasterers, carpenters, you know, what you would hope to have on any physical production. But we've also got the exact equivalent in the virtual art department, people working with, you know, sculpting programs, painting programs, you know. Then the two teams together are able to work together in a way that I'd never anticipated. The painters are giving paint samples to the virtual artists. The virtual artists are rendering out scenes and giving it to the plasterer. So it's a kind of a new departure to have this kind of collaboration and this kind of cross-pollinating of the new and the old.
You know, cross-pollinating is a beautiful way to put it. And we hope to see more of that spirit of collaboration in Star Wars shows and movies moving forward. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Oh, of course, Tanya.
That's Andrew L. Jones, production designer on The Mandalorian. The finale is available today on Disney+.
When we feel stressed, we often find comfort in food, and the pandemic is stressful. It's forced a lot of us to upend our lives and led to feelings of isolation or desperation, and it's become the breeding ground for people to develop an eating disorder or exacerbate an old one. 21-year-old Miranda Snyder of Western Massachusetts began to veer down a familiar and dangerous path in March. That's when her college in Maine sent her home because of the pandemic. She was home, but she says she felt adrift.
I just completely lost a sense of what I could control, what I was actually contributing to anything. If I wasn't having these regular interactions with my professors and my peers and my coursework. So I leaned into the familiarity of my eating disorder more intensely than I ever had before since eighth grade.
Snyder says there was the day when she was on Zoom taking a class on contemporary literature. She had her camera off and her microphone muted, and her mind began to wander.
I was scrolling through recipes on like the 10th page of Google about baking recipes and even looking at the menu of restaurants about food that I would dream to eat. I was just so painfully sick of constantly thinking about food, constantly planning out my meals in relation to the movement I would engage in that day.
Snyder's eating disorder started when she was 13. She says she obsessively compared her abilities and her appearance to those of her peers. She worked out all the time. She began to prepare for an audition for a school show choir, and things got worse.
I began measuring cereal down from like a half cup of gross fiber one cereal to a third cup to a fourth cup, having like sauteed spinach leaves and cooking spray for dinner, having a single Greek yogurt for lunch, and then jiggling my leg 100 times per calorie on each leg for the rest of the school day.
And doing compulsive crunches on her bathroom floor at home after she ate. Her parents attempted interventions several times. They finally got her into an outpatient anorexia recovery program in the area. Snyder says she existed in a quasi-recovered state until this spring, when she told her friends and parents she needed professional help again. She enrolled in a virtual partial hospitalization program run by Walden Behavioral Care. That's a Massachusetts-based eating disorders treatment organization. The founder, president, and CEO, clinical psychologist Stuart Komen, says Walden has seen a 50% increase in patient inquiries this year over last.
Generally speaking, we would run about 70 evaluations a week. We are now well into the 100 and 100-plus evaluations a week.
In the midst of the pandemic, Walden has opened a new treatment facility. It has intensive hospital floors and a residential unit.
What you'll see is there are six dining rooms throughout the building. Obviously, the food component of the program is major.
Therapists and nutritionists expose patients to a series of challenges and trials around food. The patients prepare food and eat it with meal coaches to help them out. The Walden Hospital will serve patients as young as 11. Coleman says eating disorders often show up earlier than they did before social media pressures started affecting kids. And the illness is cut across all levels of society. For some people, not having money to eat sufficiently can spark a disorder connected to food.
And it might be the first time that they've experienced food insecurity, and now all of a sudden they find themselves doing things that they've never done before and sort of embracing restriction and embracing the way of an eating disorder because they think it's somehow best for the family.
Claire Misko is the CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association.
We know that eating disorders thrive in isolation.
She's witnessed the rise in cases. The association, known as NIDA, saw an 87% increase in outreach to their helpline chat service between March and November this year compared to the same time last year.
A lot of what we're hearing is that people are feeling very alone and trying to navigate this situation where they feel a tremendous amount of anxiety. We know that eating disorders are very closely linked to trauma, to anxiety, to depression.
And even though people feel alone, Misko says she wants them to know there's help.
We knew even before the pandemic hit that cost and geography were huge barriers for people to access care. And many treatment providers have shifted their services to be available virtually.
Meanwhile, Miranda Snyder says she found meaningful help in what she refers to as her eating school at Walden. She made a point to write affirming statements in a journal several times a day through her treatment and says that was a critical part of her success. Snyder thinks back to earlier in the pandemic when she would work out or move her body compulsively to try to burn more calories for hours a day.
But now I feel free. I move when I want to in ways that are joyful for me. The most interesting thing about my life is no longer food and exercise. I realize and know my worth.
We have the number to the National Eating Disorders Helpline if you'd like to grab something to write it down. If you or someone you care about is struggling with an eating disorder, you can call 1-800-931-2222. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.